When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Governor Greg Abbott has rejected $350 million in child food assistance from the federal government. He doesn't need it. Those kids don't need to eat. We have such a great show for you today. Congressman Jared Moskowitz talks to us about his battles on the Oversight Committee with some very inept House Republicans. Then we will talk to the Daily Beast, Sam Brody, about what is happening in Congress and the Senate. But first, we have the co-host of MSNBC's The Weekend, Alicia Menendez. Welcome to Fast Politics, my friend, Alicia Menendez.
My friend, Molly Jongfast. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited that I get to have you because you may not remember this, but we did have a conversation a while ago where you're like, I will never go on your podcast because you will get me to say something bad.
I stand by that. This is going to be a bumpy ride, folks. Buckle up.
We sold this idea that we were going to have you on to talk about your new show, which starts tomorrow. So let's talk about that for 2 seconds. And then we are going to get really into politics and we're just going to give the listeners what they want. So what is the new show? And tell me how this came about.
I love that you have lured me here under false pretenses. Molly, so I'm launching a new show alongside Simone Sanders Townsend and Michael Steele, my compatriots at MSNBC. It will be on every Saturday and Sunday, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern. The news doesn't stop on Fridays, not in this news cycle. Very often when I've been on air on Saturdays or Sundays, there is news that is broken overnight. There are things that are happening in real time, and you want people that you can turn to, familiar faces, who can give you the news and context that you need to get your day started. I think of it, Molly, as the beginning of a conversation. That's the beauty of being on at AM. 8 a.m., we start a conversation that not just the other hosts and guests on MSNBC will have, but that folks who watch will have with their friends and family throughout the day. And that part to me is really exciting.
And it's a little Morning Joe format, a little bit.
How dare you? We invented this format, Molly. It is in the sense that it is a bunch of smart, informed folks around a table. I think it will have a very different flavor and different feel.
Okay, that's a really good point. And you all have worked in, especially Simone and Michael, both have worked in, and Michael was actually lieutenant governor.
Yeah, and Michael, in his role as RNC chair back in 2009, recruited a lot of the people who continue to emerge as Republican leaders and presidential hopefuls to this day. I mean, if you recall, he sort of put together that Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, I believe Raul Labrador, Chris, I mean, all of those folks emerged during Michael Steele's time at the RNC.
That's so interesting. Let's talk about what happened yesterday. I was on your show when Chris Christie came out and gave his speech. I'm curious, you give us your take and then I will rail on Chris Christie. I mean, just kidding.
He came out, he gave what to me sounded like a little bit of penance for his past role in promoting Donald Trump, which I think you can debate the authenticity of that penance. I thought laid out the stakes, the dangers of a second Trump term, the dangers of having people who are running for president, I'm paraphrasing here, but who he said, if you're not willing to say that Donald Trump is unfit to be president, then you yourself are unfit to be president, which I think is a bar worth setting. Yeah. And here's the thing, which is the reason I am interested in Christie as a messenger is because there are so few Republican messengers who can break through, not with the MAGA crowd. That's not who he is going to connect with and persuade, but perhaps some type of persuadable Republican who maybe could cast another vote for Donald Trump, but also has reservations, even some independents and more conservative Democrats who, for whatever reason, might be thinking of sitting on the sidelines on this election. I do think he has the power now or later to connect with them. And so that was why I was listening so carefully, because I do think he is very strategic. And so I thought he had cultivated a message that was intended to connect. I also think it was intended to shake things up in advance of last night's debate and then the Trump town hall. I don't think it succeeded in doing that. It's not as though the question of the stakes all of a sudden was pushed front and center, but it seemed to me as I was listening to it that that was at least part of the intent. Now your turn to rail against him.
Well, no, and I think you have a really good point. And we were just talking about this before we started recording, which is always the danger of ever talking before you're recording, especially with this, is that you said this thing, which I think Jesse and I both were like, oh, yeah, that's totally right, was that yesterday was the first day of the general. Thoughts?
Yes. Oh, I thought we were supposed to pretend like that didn't happen. I'm like, wow, what a new and novel thought, Molly.
Yes.
It was interesting to me that it's like he, being Chris Christie, didn't really even want to reckon on the record. Though, of course, he had that hot mic moment where he was criticizing both Haley and DeSantis. He's basically was saying this thing's baked, right? Like this thing is, barring some lightning bolts from the heavens, this is going to Donald Trump. It's going to be Trump versus Biden. I'm curious down the road if he's willing to engage with the possibility of endorsing or supporting Biden, given that his parameter is you are unfit to be president if you're not willing to say that Donald Trump is unfit to be president. And Donald Trump will certainly not be saying that about himself. The contours changed last night. I thought the fact that you saw Haley and DeSantis having what seemed like a really out of place, not here on earth one debate, where they were each trying to tear down the other as though the dynamic would be a normal dynamic where if there were only one person running against Trump in this primary, somehow there would be enough folks to coalesce around that single opponent in favor of diminishing him in a state like New Hampshire. And it just seemed offbeat, especially when you had Trump doing this counter-programming on Fox, where he was also treating himself as the general election candidate, which, as you and I know from following a lot of these historians and experts on authoritarianism, is from the authoritarian playbook, right? Acting as though you are inevitable, acting as though, of course, it is going to be you. I don't want to give into that narrative. At the same time, I can read poll numbers, and it does seem that Republican primary voters are lining up behind him.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I also think that watching Chris Christie, my problems with him are that I find him super self-congratulatory. And also, he was never polling, you know, more than the single digits. But in a world where there are no messengers, right? Because there was really no one except Asa Hutchinson, and Asa Hutchinson really did not have the stomach for it. There was no one else who was willing to go out there and be like, the emperor has no clothes. And so for that, that was good. And actually, I thought it was interesting. There was some reporting I read about the Haley DeSantis death spiral that we watched, which, by the way, I'm always shocked by what a bad retail politician Ron DeSantis is. Like, even when he wins, he still reads so smug to me.
Well, and the fact that he points to Florida as some sort of beacon of success is always interesting to me, too, right? I mean, I often lament the fact that this is not in any way a normal election, and they're not on stage talking about policies, by and large, that are going to impact people's lives should they ever become president. But I suppose part of the truth with Ron DeSantis is he doesn't need to tell us because he has already shown us. You just need to look at what he has done in Florida, whether that is around reproductive rights, whether that is around bullying corporations, whether that is these radical changes to education in the state, whether it's his election police force, which has succeeded in nothing other than catching Floridians in the act of trying to participate in their democracy. He doesn't need to get on stage and tell us what it is he's going to do. He's shown us. So in that way, it's like, I don't know what he could do on the debate stage that would change that.
Yeah. We're in this pivot to the general election now. Trump also pivoted Trump. You know, you can't use those two words in a sentence talking about Trump. What you have to say is like, he seemed less crazy specifically so he could go after Joe Biden. Right. I mean, that's really what it is.
I just want to be clear. We're saying tonally he seemed less crazy. His performance was less crazy. But yes, if you actually look at the content of it.
Right. He was shopping a less of an authoritarian bent. I mean, again, what Trump shops and what Trump does are not the same, right? I mean, we can agree. But he's sort of trying to walk back some of the real high crazy.
Yeah, it made me wonder, I wonder if it made you wonder too, if they are seeing in some of their polling that there are folks that are pulling away from them over some of the, I'll be a dictator on day one. I also thought his language around abortion was really interesting, right? He wanted credit with an anti-choice voter for having overturned Roe. He's like, I did for you what they were never able to do. But then also cautioned that it was politically not viable for him to win if he went too far out there on it and didn't include exceptions.
Yeah, that was really interesting. And he also like hit DeSantis on his 6-week ban, which when you've put three anti-choice justices on the court, I'm not defending DeSantis, but there was a sense in which Florida, he was just trying to keep up with everybody else's crazy abortion bans. So, you know, everything's a hammer when everything looks like a nail. I mean, that I thought was really insane. But
can we also just talk, Molly? Sorry, I do need to talk about how, like, I keep calling it a town hall because I'm a good girl and I want to like follow protocol, but it was not a town hall. It was a pep rally with some questions. And of course he did well because he was surrounded by adoring fans. That like that is a premise for him to have success and to behave normally, right? The number of exchanges where the Fox host would ask, well, who are you supporting? They'd be like, Donald Trump. And then he'd be like, thank you. You're beautiful. Like this is not normal. Like there's even the folks who are like, I'm, you know, going to caucus for DeSantis. We're like, but you are amazing. Like it's just like you need to have some tough skin to be president of the United States. You can't constantly be surrounded. We always talk about how he wants to be surrounded by yes men. He also just wants to be surrounded
by sycophants. Yeah. I mean, that's the whole Donald Trump ethos is that you bully people into being sycophants around you. But there has been an intentional pullback of his autocratic talk, Donald Trump, despite the fact that he is an autocrat. We know he's an autocrat. We saw he's an autocrat. I truly believe this is the if you want to have elections anymore election. But he's clearly decided that the general has started and he's not running again. Remember, Trump is not running against Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. He's running against another very, very centrist white guy. There's a sort of pivot to like trying to be a little bit more general and seem less crazy. I am seeing the pundits that you and I both know, some who we like, some who we don't, who are like buying this. Haven't we been doing this for a decade?
Oh, my. I must be in my own bubble because I have not seen that.
I'll send it to you.
It's performance art. I think we all know that at this point. And you said something, and I think there's a duality here. And I feel like you were like heady enough for me to inset this concept with you, which is, I remember reading this article years ago where Lady Gaga was describing her art and like what she loves about art. And she was saying it was all about slipping. I forget if it was a lie in among two truths or truth in among two lies, but that was what made art interesting and compelling. And I do think that there is some corollary. Sorry, Gaga, I don't mean to offend you for what Donald Trump does, which is, you said something which is true, which is he says things and they're not always true and you can't believe him. Conversely, he also says things that are very true and you should believe him, like, I want to be a dictator on day one, LOL.
Right.
And he wants to be like, well, you're so dramatic. You're taking me way too seriously. And it's like, well, there were people who didn't take you seriously in the lead up to January 6th. There were people who didn't take you seriously when that call with Raffensperger was released. There were people who this entire time doubted you. So it is both things, Molly, right? There are times when he says things that you absolutely cannot take him at his word for. And then there are times where you need to accept that he is deadly serious. And we're asking people to do something that is pretty high level and complex, which is to sift through which is which. To know when he is saying, I am actually committed to this, and when he is saying what he needs to say because it's politically expedient. And I think one of the things I felt, I was watching his town hall / pep rally last night with James Ciccarella, one of the producers on the weekend. And he and James noted to me that one of the challenges is Trump says so many things, but yet is most often sparse on details, so that you can transpose onto him whatever you want, especially if you are someone who is in the window of being willing to support him, right? That there's a lot where you can be like, he doesn't mean that. Oh, he's kind of being vague about this. So I'm going to take what I want and what I believe is right on this specific policy position and transpose it onto him. And he leaves a lot of room to do that. He's not like, you know, filling out the surveys for advocacy groups about, will you support SB 999? No, it's like he's keeping options open.
That's a really good point. And it's funny, you do really see that. You really do see he gets the benefit of the doubt endlessly. It feels like fellow Republicans are addicted to giving him the benefit of the doubt. And I even think about like the world's most famous, just he's playing golf. He's not like, what's the harm of humoring him, right? That's the unnamed Republican senator who says, what's the harm of humoring him? He's just playing some golf. It's not like he's going to overturn the 2020 election. That was like how we got here. That's the Batman origin story, right? Of how we got to not half the country, but a large percentage of the Republican Party believes that Donald Trump won the 2020 election. And that in fact, he is righting a wrong done to them, which of course is absolute bullshit, but is going to be a central tenet of this election.
Damn you, Molly Jongfast, for the Batman reference, because now I'm going to have Kissed by a Rose on the Grave by C.L. Bleach just like playing in my head from the best Batman movie of all time. I share your alarm that we are here at this meeting at this moment after all these years of covering him, and there is still a subset of the pundit class that's willing to just focus on tone over substance. The man's a performer. I think there are core questions about which you and I just violently agree, like the idea that because this isn't a normal election, you have to focus on the stakes and not the odds. I think there are also these questions that I have heard compelling arguments for in both directions, which is, do you share enough of what he is saying and doing to keep people aware of the depths of his depravity? Or in doing it and showing him, are you simply platforming him? And where is the line between those two things? And I think because he is such a performance artist and because he knows how to capture attention and he knows how to, you know, jujitsu things in a million ways, whether it is taking all of these legal cases and somehow fundraising off of them and seeming to use them to his political advantage, whether it is taking something like, you know, the fact that he has proven himself to be a danger to democracy, and yet he is trying to take that attack and actually launch it against President Biden without fact and without proof points. And I think part of what he understands is it doesn't matter whether or not people believe that. It just matters that there is chaos in the ether.
No, and I think that's a really good point. I actually believe that we have to cover him. We can't, because otherwise, if we don't cover how crazy he is, we are going to end up, you know, it's funny, but it's like he wrote all this free media. So you have to cover him as a truth sandwich, right? You have to say, this is a lie and this is a lie. So you can't give him a microphone. But if you don't cover him, I mean, people want to give him the benefit of the doubt, even people. And I wonder how much of like media is actually baked in that way, right? Like, if you think about it, there is a predisposition that many of us have. And I'm not even sure that I don't have it to some degree of normalcy bias, which we can absolutely talk about more, but now we are out of time.
Well, that's good, because there's somehow also a helicopter overhead for me right now. So that's like our audio cue to depart.
Your show starts tomorrow. It will be 8 to 10 Saturdays and Sundays. Very exciting. Very excited for you. Congratulations.
Thank you, Molly. Thank you, my friend.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Congressman Jared Moskowitz represents Florida's 23rd District. Welcome to Fast Politics, Congressman Jared Moskowitz.
Well, thanks, Molly. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to have you on to talk about this incredible hearing yesterday. Set the stage for us. What was this hearing? What committee is this? What committee are you on? This is your first term in Congress. Just give us a little background.
So this is the Oversight Committee, which is chaired by Chairman Comer. And all year, we have had hearings just like we had yesterday. You know, these are not the same hearings that I have in my other committee, which is Foreign Affairs, which are bipartisan and fact-finding and really wanting to do the business of the committee. Here, this is a government oversight committee. Obviously, we have a giant government. There's all sorts of oversight. Not everyone's crushing it. I'm sure there's all sorts of legitimate things we could be looking at in the executive branch to further the lives of Americans. But no, that's not what this committee has been used for. This is literally the election mailer committee. It's literally the please Donald Trump committee. It's literally do whatever the Donald Trump campaign tells us committee. And all year long, they have been going after, you know, Joe Biden and pretending like he's the head of the Biden crime family, which, you know, turning Joe Biden to Tony Soprano, by the way, is a tall order. And they talk out of both sides of their mouth, right? Joe Biden is sleepy. He's sleepy. He doesn't know where he's going, but he's also Tony Soprano running the Biden crime family. And that's what has been going on all year in this committee. But it's not been going well. The impeachment hearing was a total disaster for them a couple of months ago when their own witness said there wasn't any evidence to impeach Joe Biden on. And yesterday was the Hunter Biden contempt hearing. And the reason why this is interesting is because normally, if you get a subpoena from Congress and you don't comply, you should be held in contempt. And I agree with that. You can't blow off a congressional subpoena. But that's not what's happened here. What's happened here is the chairman, and one of my Republican colleagues said this is why we shouldn't pick our chairman based on how much money they raise. We should pick our chairman on ability. But the chairman, Chairman Comer, on multiple programs told Hunter Biden on national TV he can choose. He can choose whether he wants a public hearing or a deposition. Well, Hunter Biden took the chairman's invitation and said, I'll do a public hearing. Because what we've seen in these private depositions is they hold the deposition, they do selective leaks, they never release the full transcript, and the American people never hear the full story. It's one-sided. That's what they want to do with Hunter. And so yesterday was the contempt hearing because Hunter didn't show up for the private deposition, but instead has taken the chairman up on his public invitation, which the chairman is now pretending as if it never happened.
This oversight committee, which has become the weaponization of the federal government against the Democratic president in the hopes of pleasing Donald Trump, this oversight committee is desperate to get Hunter Biden to testify, but only privately. Can you explain why that is?
If the cameras are on and the American people are watching, they'll hear both sides. They'll hear the questions and then they'll hear the answers and they'll hear the whole thing, whether it's 10 hours or 12 hours. Right. We all remember like Hillary sitting in the hearing during Benghazi. Right. That was like a deposition. She took 11 hours of questions. But the American people got to see it. They got to hear the whole conversation. The reason why the Republicans don't want to do that is they don't want the American people to hear all of what Hunter Biden has to say. They only want to release maybe the one or two or three things that they think fits their narrative, and then not release the other 95% of the information because they control the transcript. When you're in the majority, you control what you release, when you release it, and you can control the transcript. And these other depositions that they've had all year, they have not released the transcripts from these depositions. In fact, they've never released his laptop, Molly. We've heard the fact that they have Hunter Biden's laptop. We've asked to see it so that we can verify the information on it. And they've not let us look at the information.
Because they know it won't help them.
They don't want to bring sunlight into the process. They don't want to bring transparency into the process. They want to talk, you know, the couple of talking points that fit their narrative, you know, to try to paint this in the worst way, to try to, you know, selectively choose facts rather than hearing, like, think about it, right? If you took anyone's deposition, anybody's, and you sat with anyone's deposition for 5 hours and you cherry picked two or three things from that deposition, right? And you only released that, everyone would think the whole deposition was like that. They would think, oh my God, like that's clearly the picture of this deposition. If you're holding back 95% of the rest of the deposition, you're giving it no context. You're giving it no clarity. Right. That's why they want to do this. Because what I think they're doing at the moment is, you know, this is all about trying to hurt Joe Biden's poll numbers. They've admitted that.
Well, Benghazi worked really well for them.
Benghazi worked really well for them. And this is the Benghazi strategy. We'll see if they ever decide to impeach the president. But in the meantime, they've said, since we've started our investigation, Joe Biden's poll numbers have gone down. So they don't want the American people to hear the full story. They want to tell the story they want to tell, mostly to their echo chamber. But some of that leaks out, some of that leaks over, because the problem is, if you have a hearing, everyone's going to cover the hearing. They're going to cover the deposition, and they're going to cover the three or four things that they leak out. And then that will become national news. That will become the headline. And then 6 months from now, when the transcript comes out that disproves everything they said, it's gone. It's too late to get the truth back in the way information flows today in the media and online.
This is really interesting. As we're looking at this oversight committee led by James Comer. James Comer yesterday said, "You are just like George Santos." He Maria Bartiromo.
That's just because we're both Jewish, Molly.
No, he said, I'm sorry, not Maria Bartiromo. He said to Laura Ingraham.
Right. I have to invite her to my next Passover. Got to develop that relationship.
You won't run into her in shul. As a Jew myself, Laura Ingraham has also been very negative about me. I feel like we're not her people. She said, Comer said, Moskowitz has less credibility than George Santos. So is he just decided that if he says your name with George Santos is that people will think you're both crimey?
I think, quite frankly, what happened is in very slow motion. I'm going to slow motion exactly what you saw take place.
Yes,
Laura Ingraham asked a question.
Yes.
Right. A quarter of James's brain tried to figure out what the answer was. And then the only thing that popped into his mind, right, because we didn't want to use all the brain cells, but the only thing that popped into his mind was George Santos. And he was like, he's got less credibility than George Santos. And then after the interview, you know, he like patted himself on the back after that one. He was like, that was good. That was really good. I did George Santos, you know, but whatever. I mean, he's called me Little Moskowitz. He's called me a Smurf.
Oh, that's right. He called you a Smurf.
Yeah, he called me a Smurf. He called me Little Moskowitz. And now he's calling me George Santos. I mean, listen, I guess I'm going to have to declare on my financial form the real estate I now taken in his brain. I have to list that on my form as real estate I now own, because he just can't stop thinking about me.
Marjorie Taylor Greene yet again put up nudes of Hunter Biden. This is the second time. And I think that was why he left the hearing, right?
Yes. He knew that was going to happen just because it's Marjorie.
Yes. So this is the second time that she's done that, is put up nudes of him. And you, as a response, you put up this giant poster of Epstein and Trump, which is, by the way, like the thing that Republicans hate most. I shouldn't even say Republicans. They're not Republicans. They're Trumpists. They hate most is the reminder that Donald Trump, well, Bill Clinton was good friends with Jeff Epp. So was Donald Trump.
The Republicans are out there every day and they're talking about kids and kids in school and what they're reading and grooming and pedophiles. They're talking about that every day. And then all of a sudden, you know, more and more news continues to leak that their guy, the guy, you know, that they just can't get enough of, you know, is on the plane with Jeffrey Epstein. He's been to Epstein Island. And he even knows, like, you know, I mean, the pictures are endless with him and Epstein. They literally like put their head in a hole like an ostrich. They pretend like that didn't happen, like those photos don't exist. And so every hearing I print out some stuff. Sometimes I use it, sometimes I don't.
And the staffers love it when you do that.
No, the staffers hate it. My staff hates when I print things that are probably slightly over the edge. Yeah, I'm trying to keep as much decorum as I can, Molly. It's just kind of hard.
This is really important. What I want to ask you about is, like, there is this idea that Democrats are supposed to behave like it's 1998, despite the fact that Republicans are behaving like they work at Fox News. So I actually think what you're doing is, I don't want to encourage you and I don't want your staffers to be mad at me, but I'm going to encourage you because I actually think that this is really the only way we're going to survive.
Well, that is actually the intent. The intent is to be ready when they do that, but the intent is to fight fire with fire. I don't want to play those games. It's actually not who I am. I'm actually, quite frankly, more of a middle of the ground, moderate guy, make bipartisan deals because I want to help the American people. This is actually not who I am, but I'm not going to sit in these hearings while they lie to the American people and play these games. And if that's what they're going to do, then I'm going to show them that we can play these games and we can play it better than they can.
Because they're ultimately pretty dumb.
Not all of them. But yes, some of them mail it in. And they're what they're not used to is they're not used to a Democrat pushing back with such aggressive strategy. They're used to us being slightly more passive. And so, yeah, if she's going to show nudes of Hunter Biden, I'm going to show pictures of their guy, you know, DJT and Jeffrey Epstein. And I was prepared to do that, hoping, by the way, that she wasn't going to show those photos, but having little faith in her that she was absolutely going to do that.
And you had just about the right amount of faith, I think it's fair to say.
Well, always be prepared. I have an emergency management background. As a former emergency management director who had to deal with all sorts of disasters, you always want to be ready for different contingencies.
So one of the things that I think is interesting about this oversight committee is that the people on it really are the sort of very Lauren Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Anna Paulina Luna. I mean, it really is a rogues gallery of just the MAGA caucus.
Well, they built a TV committee. In fairness to what I think their strategy was, I think their strategy was they knew they were going to put on a Broadway show for 2 years. And so what they did is they put their performers on there. You know, they put their TV people on there. And
Andy,
I think,
Biggs.
Yeah. And I think Hakeem Jeffries, by the way, saw what they did because they released their committee first. And when he saw what they did, I think he looked around at the pieces that he had that weren't on other committees. And if you look at what Hakeem Jeffries assembled, I mean, Jamie Raskin has crushed it as the ranking member, soon to be chairman of that committee. You know, you got Dan Goldman, you got, you know, Jerry Connolly, he's been fantastic. Jasmine Crockett, who's been amazing. You know, Maxwell Frost on the committee. You know, you have AOC as the rank, is the vice ranking member. She's been great. Katie Porter's been amazing. I mean, so Hakeem took these other pieces and said, if that's what they're going to do, we're going to be ready for battle. And this committee has become kind of like a WWE Royal Rumble battle royale. And so, yeah, I'm slightly more aggressive in that committee than I want to be. And I'm definitely more aggressive in that committee than I am in foreign affairs. But we can't just sit there while they do this one-sided nonsense and pretend like all of the problems in America never existed until Joseph Biden became the president, right? Like, we never had any problem in this country. It was wonderful. There weren't things to fix. There weren't things to make better. Everything was great. But then Joe Biden became president, and that's when we started to ruin the country.
That's their messaging on immigration, right? That if the border was fine under Trump, which it was not, right? I mean, again, I actually believe that immigration is good and that our country is all built on it. But even if you were to say that the immigration is a problem, which I don't think it is, you would still have to say that this has been a continual, quote unquote, problem under Trump built a wall, but he still couldn't figure out how to deal with this.
The border, look, there's a push-pull effect going on. And look, I do think there are problems at the border, Molly, but these problems have existed for 20 years.
Right.
Okay. Because we've refused to address immigration. Remember, George W. Bush tried to get it done. We got close and it didn't happen.
But, you know, I just had Barbara Boxer on this podcast and she said the reality is Republicans, they want this to be a problem because otherwise they have nothing to run on.
Yes. You literally have, I'm not going to name them because there's too many to name, but you literally have Congress people coming out even yesterday, literally saying, this is a direct quote, I'm not going to vote for any deal that fixes the situation at the border because I'm not helping Joe Biden's reelection. That's a direct quote.
Yeah, they don't want a solution.
Yeah, and that unfortunately is not indicative of this issue. That unfortunately is pervasive in Washington, especially when we're in election year. Solving problems, if it helps the other side, you know, we don't want to solve the problem for the American people.
But what's interesting here is you have a situation right now where you have a Republican Party in the House that is having a lot of trouble getting along with each other.
Molly, what are you talking about? This has been the most productive Congress that we have ever seen.
That's right, except for any legislation.
Except for the fact that the average bills passed in a Congress are 300. We've only done 30. So we are the least productive Congress in three decades. The largest things we've accomplished is we've removed a speaker and expelled a member. We're threatening to shut the government down every 75 days. We can't help our friends in Israel or Ukraine. We can't even pass like commemorative dog coin bills for like working dogs out there. Molly, there are bills that have like 250 sponsors. Like there's a bill out there that would, for all those working dogs out there that help people in their daily lives, there's a bill to create a commemorative coin. There's like 250 sponsors of that bill, Democrats and Republicans. That bill's not moving. You can't even move that bill. Nancy Pelosi, I think, said this morning on Morning Joe, this is the worst she's seen it in 35 years.
Right. We got Mike Johnson in there. Do you think that Mike Johnson ends up, you know, there's still a one person motion to vacate? You know, he's got this tiered CR. You know, I mean, do you think this ends in shutdown? Do you think this ends in him getting kicked out again? I mean, you are there on the ground. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, Mike Johnson has compared himself to Moses. So
yeah, he's just like Moses.
Yeah. Is he going to be the Moses that wandered in the desert for 40 years or is he going to be the Moses that led us through the Red Sea? It's unclear. I don't think they will make a motion to vacate and actually go through the vote and remove him again. I mean, look, they're already doing everything they can do to get back into the minority. It's clear they want back in the minority in the House. That's where they feel comfortable. They're not interested in governing. They're not interested in helping the American people do anything positive or moving the country forward. So they're doing everything they can to get back there. They may. There are some that may use those mechanisms maybe to force him to resign. But by the way, who's going to want this job? Nobody's going to want this job with a two-vote majority and an ungovernable, you know, amount of members, 12 of them at any given time that, you know, can't listen to anything and just want to burn the country to the ground. Part of me has no sympathy for Mike Johnson, but the other part of me, which is like the part that cares about someone's mental health, I have no idea how he's even doing this, quite frankly. It is just unbelievable what that party is going through right now. And you know what it is? Let's just be honest. Donald Trump broke them. He broke them. Mm. They're still broken. Okay. And they're going to be this year leading up to the election to see whether or not they're going to have to live with Donald Trump for four more years or whether Donald Trump will, you know, go to the pages of a history book before we remove him. Just kidding. You know, this is my first year here. I mean, if this is what Congress is now, the American people, if this is what Congress is now going forward, the American people and U.S. government are being trouble. If this is a blip on the radar, it's one thing, but this is just an unbelievable moment in history in which the largest branch of government, because we're 435 members, right? There's 100 senators, 435. We cannot function, and we're showing that to the world.
Thank you, Congressman.
Appreciate it, Molly. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sam Brody is a deputy politics editor at The Daily Beast. Welcome to Fast Politics, Sam Brody.
Thanks for having me.
So the United States House of Representatives, sacred ground filled with serious people. Talk to me about yesterday.
So yesterday was one of the crazier days we've seen unfold in the House of Representatives in at least 2 weeks. No, I mean, by the standards that this House has set, obviously, you know, folks will recall what happened last year and just scenes of drama that are really unprecedented. Even by those standards, what happened yesterday was pretty notable. So let's just rewind. Congress began the day with an oversight committee hearing in which Hunter Biden unexpectedly showed up. Nancy Mace began yelling uncontrollably about that he had no balls and that he had white privilege in showing up. It completely devolved into bedlam. And on the House floor, we got a just really, really stark illustration of how completely paralyzed this House Republican majority is and really how unable Speaker Mike Johnson is to do almost anything. So we'll get into the weeds, I guess, here briefly. But before you do anything on the House floor, like literally anything, they need to pass a rule. And so that's just like jargon for that sets the parameters for debate and sets you up to pass ultimately or vote on whatever bill that you're considering that day. And historically, rule votes do not fail. The entire majority party votes for the rule. It's pro forma. Nancy Pelosi, in 20 years of being speaker, not once lost a vote. And now this is happening
on a rules because it's not something you're supposed to lose.
Exactly. Even if you vote against the bill, ultimately, you just vote for the rule. If your party's in charge, that's just what happens. And so now this has happened all the time. And it happened a lot at the end of McCarthy's tenure. But now what's happening is people who backed getting rid of McCarthy are doing the same thing to Mike Johnson. So there was a rule just to get started. I mean, it wasn't even a rule to pass an appropriations bill. So let's also keep in mind that a partial government shutdown is just a few days away. This was a rule to pass a symbolic resolution disapproving of a Biden administration policy on electric cars. That rule was defeated and the House was paralyzed. Nothing could happen. And the reason that happened is that conservatives remain angry that Mike Johnson really has no choice but to stick to a spending deal that McCarthy, Biden, and Chuck Schumer agreed to last year for top line budget numbers for the coming year. They have had a temper tantrum about this for months. It helped result in McCarthy's departure. Nothing magically changed when Mike Johnson took the speakership. Instead of trying to work with him and get a better deal, these conservatives are just holding the House floor hostage until something happens. We'll see if anything ends up happening today.
So one of the things that we noticed is that yesterday there started to be whispering about a motion to vacate for Mike Johnson. That would be because you'll remember Mike Johnson never changed the rules. So there still is a one-person motion to vacate in the House. And there was some whispering about it yesterday. That's the first time that's happened because he did have originally some goodwill, right? So he has this CR, this continuing resolution to finance the government. It expires, I think, in 2 weeks.
So what they did was they split it in half, which was a bizarre thing to do. So some of the programs...
It's a tiered CR. The first time ever, yes.
The first time ever, you got to wonder why no one's done that before. I believe it's in a week that the first shutdown, partial shutdown would happen. And then the other round is in about a month. On the motion to vacate, yeah, you know, to this point, Johnson has enjoyed a little bit of a honeymoon period where people are, you know, going to let him work and build his, you know, operation and just sort of see what happened. And yesterday there was a really pivotal moment, I think, that heightened the drama of everything that happened, which is there was this private House Republican conference meeting in which Johnson was briefing members on the kind of renewed agreement that they came to. And people just stormed out, even people inclined to support Johnson, saying, you know, this is a joke. This guy, Warren Davidson from Ohio, said, you know, we never should have hired Johnson in the first place. The more establishment aligned people are just throwing up their hands and remarking about how they literally can't do anything. I mean, you're seeing members say on the record like that it is a complete disaster, which is just shocking.
What I think is interesting, though, is that what happened here is that you have a pretty large section of this House Republican Party that their entire ethos is burning down the federal government. So those people continually are furious whenever their speaker has to do something that is about funding the federal government. I mean, that's really where we are. That's why they keep ending up in fisticuffs, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, like, this is the story of the modern, you know, Republican Party, which is there is a like critical mass of members of the House who have no incentive really to govern, to compromise, to put forward spending, because their constituents will view anything that has any Democratic support at any part of the process as a capitulation, and it's going to get you a primary challenger and your life is going to be made more difficult. There's just enough of these people who are willing to just say, screw it, whatever, we're going to say no to everything. They are not going to get punished really for it, by their voters at least. And so, you know, we've seen that dynamic just completely turbocharged in this House Republican majority. But here's where it gets interesting a little bit with the motion to vacate, because you're right in that it's starting to get mentioned. The sword of Damocles is always hanging there over Mike Johnson. Sometimes it's like, you don't really need to say it's there. Everyone knows it's there. But Chip Roy has talked about it. And so I remain skeptical that anything will come of this. I'll talk a little bit about why. I think for one, the McCarthy situation was unique. And I think the revolt over McCarthy was really personal and vibes-based as much as it was anything else.
Yeah, it was Matt Gaetz, right? Matt Gaetz mad at McCarthy.
Exactly. Matt Gaetz hated McCarthy, and it's sort of known on Capitol Hill in large part because of the ongoing ethics investigation into Matt Gaetz, which McCarthy couldn't do anything about. And the others wanted publicity and all that kind of thing. So it wasn't about policy. And so they got the trophy. McCarthy went down. Matt Gaetz will take many victory laps. And I think it's been telling. I mean, Matt Gaetz himself dismissed talk of the motion to vacate, their support for Johnson. And I think even the most, you know, delusional of this crew probably understand that what good is it going to do them to get rid of Mike Johnson and go through this process again? I mean, it broke the party last time. If it happened again, it would be a nuclear level event from which the party probably could not recover. And that's probably a scenario where you'd see a moderate speaker or compromise speaker or something like that that was talked about last time.
There is no one, right? This guy is number four. We had McCarthy was out. Then there was talk of Steve Scalise. Steve Scalise is not even in Congress right now. He's getting treatment, right?
No, Johnson was number seven.
Oh, okay. So perfect. Seven. So then Emmers, who tried, and Trump was like, no, little buddy. And then I thought Johnson was four in the leadership.
That honor is Elise Stefanik.
Oh, Elise Stefanik. Right. I guess Elise Stefanik.
Who did not run for anything.
Because she's running for vice president.
Well, but yeah, but your point is right. There was no one. And I remember covering the speaker drama and members would say, you know, when they landed on Johnson, I had a member tell me, like, Johnson is one of the two or three people who could get this. That's saying a lot. And so, you know, they all know, like, these are all structural problems. These are all problems with their party. Johnson is inheriting this and he's attempting to govern. And so this is always going to be the conflict, is that no matter how conservative the person is that gets in the position, no matter how much they ally themselves with the hardliners, if you're in that post, you're going to be expected to keep the place moving. And so that's the conflict we're seeing play out.
And these Republicans' whole gestalt is to not keep the place moving.
That's right. And I mean, I think it should be said too that there is a pretty large wing of the party that does want to pass these appropriations bills. They are very, very mad at the state of affairs. I mean, these are the guys who are coming out of the conference meeting and sort of just lamenting their inability to govern and talking about how, you know, they don't deserve the majority and things like that. They're watching the party lose their majority in real time. I mean, you have members on the record talking about their failure to pass appropriations bills to do the literal most basic thing that Congress is supposed to do, how that's going to affect their chances in November. Steve Womack of Arkansas, who's a very like establishment governing wing aligned Republican, made this very point yesterday. And so they all know that this is probably where it's heading. So while it's important to talk about how much power these hardliners have to just grind everything to a halt and how the incentives for them are just to do that, Johnson is under a lot of pressure from important members of his party, including the people who are going to make or break the majority in November, to get something done. And so that's the position he finds himself in.
But one of the big problems that Johnson has is that his majority keeps shrinking. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy. But last Kevin in December, there's a couple other members who actually are retiring and can't seemingly get out of there fast enough and aren't even filling the rest of their terms, but are leaving.
Yes. Isn't that unusual?
It's pretty unusual. Sometimes you'll see a member leave early for like a time sensitive job or something else, but it's unusual this level.
They lost Santos. I mean, I think like in my mind, like one of the most evocative moments in this Congress was Republicans decided to do this vote on Santos. And then at the last minute, the entire leadership team changed from kick him out to keep him, because it was like all of a sudden they were like with a napkin doing math.
Yeah, it was that. And I'm sure they wanted him to stay, but they were wary of being seen as working too hard to keep him. And so I think they tried to split the baby there in a way that just totally didn't work out at all. But yeah, I mean, there's a reason McCarthy didn't do anything about Santos when he was in charge. He knew what was going to happen. And so that's where they are.
So now they have a special election coming in New York 3. And then they have a majority that is like, what are the numbers? It's a bunch of non-voting seats, right? And then one or two voting seats, right?
So there's two vacancies right now. And there's 220 Republicans and 213 Democrats. So the vacancies are the Santos seat and the McCarthy seat. And they will not be filled. The special election for New York 3 is in February, I guess. And then I think the election for McCarthy seat is in a few more months. But then they're going to have another vacancy because some guy in Ohio is leaving to become a university president. And so you're going to just kind of continually have these problems. Also, you know, we're seeing members since coming back from the break, more are coming out to announce they're not running for re-election. State filing deadlines are coming up. I expect we'll see more members announce their plans to retire. And some of those may also include people who leave before the term is up. You just don't know. The margins could not possibly feet higher. It really is underscores just how impossible Mike Johnson's situation is. He has no breathing room whatsoever. Even if he did, he has a crew of about a dozen Republicans in his own conference who basically have the power to make or break anything that happens on the floor. And there doesn't seem to be a plan.
And he has no experience.
That's really the thing to underscore is he's been around in Congress since 2017. He had a minor position in the leadership. He was a conservative guy from the sidelines, a committee guy. No leadership, like true experience on like, how do you run the place? Didn't sit on appropriations or any of the big governing committees. And he has had to build his operation as all of this has been going on. I think that's what makes the motion to vacate stuff really empty from somebody like Chip Roy, who does know how the place works. I imagine that Chip Roy understands that if you vacate Johnson, okay, get somebody else in there, and then they're going to have to build an organization from the ground up again. How is that going to help? I think something that was telling of the whole situation was Thomas Massey, who is a very right-wing conservative from Kentucky.
Once a libertarian, now just a person who wants to destroy the federal government.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, he's a little weird because he's like a big DeSantis guy, not a Trump guy. Anyway, he did back McCarthy, but he is somebody who votes no on almost every piece of legislation. He did support McCarthy, but he tweeted a meme, I think yesterday, that was a photo of McCarthy and it just said, "Miss me yet?" And right. I think that does encapsulate how even a lot of conservatives are feeling, which is that, yeah, maybe McCarthy got some stuff wrong. They didn't like him wrong on some respects or didn't trust him, whatever. But that he was probably the only person who was positioned to run the conference. Now he's gone and they're stuck with Mike Johnson and they are careening towards a shutdown with no real plan.
Exactly. I mean, now the one, I think, data point here that's useful is that, I mean, the thinking is that the base will love a shutdown. Those hearings yesterday where we had Marjorie Taylor Greene chasing Hunter Biden out of the room, right? And then she wasn't really, but Hunter Biden was there. You know, the Republican comms operation sent out a tweet that said Marjorie Taylor Greene chases Hunter Biden out of the hearing. Do the Republicans think that this is, I mean, do they feel like, is this their caravan? Is this what they're going to be doing for the 2020 election? And do they think this helps them?
The Hunter Biden stuff?
Yeah. And also just the really embarrassing bad behavior, that kind of, you know, screaming, you know, you have no balls. I mean, that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they, you know, the most consequential thing that happened in the House of Representatives yesterday was that Marjorie Taylor Greene showed pictures of Hunter Biden's dick. I mean,
again.
Yeah, again, after a whole dust up about the first time. Look, I here's the way I view it is Republicans are hopelessly divided. The level of acrimony within the party is at just unbelievable highs. There is not much that really unites them and gets them rowing in the same direction, except for really two things, the border and Hunter Biden. And so you better believe that they're going to desperately try and change the subject and focus on the only things that really unite them. And look, you know, they clearly decided that, you know, from a political perspective, they're going to use these probes to bloody the president and see what happens and create a lot of smoke and see if it'll stick with voters. I think they're already kind of too far down that road to change. But yeah, you know, it probably was a welcome thing to change the subject. I think they'd probably rather have the media talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene's antics than the fact that they, you know, could not fulfill even the most basic task of governing in the legislative body.
Sam Brody, that was great. I really appreciate you. And that was exactly right. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Always love talking about the House of Representatives.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jungfest, you know, Elon, he's always tweeting through it, but somehow some people can't see the very obvious hints at what his political ideology is.
Elon Musk was right-wing, or at least he certainly seemed right-wing, but he has, as he has been tweeting through it, revealed himself to be red-pilled, to be MAGA, to be anti-immigrant. And in fact, every tweet.
I think we could go a little further and just go full on white supremacist at this point.
He really has become the kind of South African billionaire that I, in my heart, always knew he was. You're going to see a lot of him complaining about the caravan, him worried about bloodlines.
Referring people to Stephen Miller's White Grievance law firm.
And also, he'll probably start using Stephen Miller's hair in a can.
No, he bought the good stuff. Come on.
Anyway, all of this is why Elon Musk, beneficiary of government contracts and white nationalist, is our moment of fuckery. That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.